Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and we're at the interview part of the show, and today we are going a little bit different. We normally stick to nonfiction or cults or mysteries of something that happened, and we've been touching off on some fiction lately, and there's some really, really good writers that do some incredible stories. Now, I've been listening to this book for a while too, and it's just it's an incredible book. I love the way
Thank
it's
you.
Done. And the book I'm talking about, so people know, it's Dodging and Burning, and the writer is with us via phone today, John Copenhaver. I'm glad you can make it.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Now, John, where did your writing come from? Like, what made you get into doing these types of stories and crime stories, and where does that come from?
Well, you know, I originally kind of started off my writing life really when I was much younger, although I wasn't writing. I was making a lot of home movies where I would get my friends together and tell murder mystery stories. Like, I'd write a script for them and pull out like my mom's old camcorder. I get pretty old by today's standards. And, you know, as a kid, I was completely inspired and read lots of Agatha Christie, of course, and Sherlock Holmes and you know, all that stuff that you'll probably find in a lot of mystery writers' paths, you know. But I didn't really start thinking about myself as a writer first. I really started thinking about myself as a storyteller. And then, like, so I would wrangle all my friends, I think much to their chagrin, although they were good sports, and I would sort of tell these wacky stories, which are pretty hilarious, especially since I grew up in southwestern Virginia, so I have a real sort of mountain twang originally to my voice. These old videos are pretty hilarious. But, you know, I think I'd always wanted to tell stories, and eventually through high school and through college, my interest sort of moved away from mystery more to, you know, literary fiction. Mainly not because I wasn't interested in writing mystery fiction, but it felt like the world was telling me I needed to write literary fiction, and whatever that means. I don't necessarily think there's this dividing line between the two, but, you know, sometimes the publishing world does. But Anyway, I got my MFA at George Mason, and after I got the MFA, I said, you know what I really love? I really love mysteries, and I want to tell one. And I think that in a lot of ways what I was doing, even when I was writing sort of short stories and stuff in my MFA, even my MFA thesis, sort of, you know, really, you know, the narrative is sort of a mystery narrative. So I think it's really kind of where I come from. I think I've always been wanting to tell mystery stories to tell the truth. So
where do you draw your influence from? Like when I write some books too, and even Mike's writing a book now, but we're in the nonfiction, so we go out and
meet
people and get the story and see the cops and see, like, we're getting the actual, you know, from what happened. So we're not doing like what you do, and that really fascinates me, because it's entertaining and it's done well. And so where do you draw your influence, like, for your characters?
In a lot of ways, I mean, maybe this is true for every fiction writer, they're always sort of pieces or fragments of yourself. I think there's always a question that you're having about yourself or your background that you're asking with each character. It's not like the whole person, but these little parts. And so I think every character, at least every developed character, I should say, that I have is in some way is a piece of myself. You know, that maybe I see reflected in the world around me, or I kind of want to explore in some way. You know, with Dodging and Burning, I was definitely thinking about my mother, who was Ciola, the younger of the two narrators' age, right at the time that these events would have occurred. So she was exactly Ciola's age in 1945, 46, that time period. And so, you know, I just had questions about her upbringing, what the world was like. You know, being a gay man and in that time period, of course, my question was, what would have that been like? How difficult would it have been? And so that clearly helped sort of inform, Dodging and Burning in a lot of ways. But I think generally speaking, I'm always, you know, I mean, I guess it's really, you know, very self-centered activity. You are always kind of writing about yourself. You know, I really like to sort of put, you know, I love to bolster the fiction with a lot of research. So I certainly appreciate research a great deal and really look for it in the things that I read. So, you know, that impulse is there, but it's a little different because you are inventing the story instead of reporting on the story, that's finding a way to sort of tell a story that's happened. So I guess that's a little different, but... I think that's kind of where I come from.
Well, I agree. I mean, when I'm putting together even a nonfiction, I still want to find what's going on, especially an older crime or something, and get the atmosphere of the community in the book. So I think it adds texture, and a lot of people reading it might not have been around, or they don't know what was going on, you know, even just as close as the 60s and 70s, you know, it's time's flying. So, you know,
absolutely.
So that's important. But it's fascinating to me how you can develop the character through the story. Like, how do you come up with what they're feeling and how they are as a character, like how they say things, how they word things, how they phrase it, how they talk about different subjects. I find that fascinating, of how well you can get this person in your story. You know, so you get to know so much about them, and where does that, is that just your imagination?
Essentially it is, but I guess there's kind of a process to it. I mean, and I think this is, you know, it's going to be very different for different writers. I tend to kind of have a sense of a character's, almost more of a surface sense of them, whether it's sort of a mannerism that they have or a look that they have. And then I think I start exploring, you know, the novel that I've just finished that I've been working on now, and true for Dodging and Burning as well, I got about 80 pages in, and I had to go back and do a lot of revising to really figure out who they were. So I kind of start with a situation and an idea of who I think they are, and mood even, and then I sort of continue to revise and excavate the character. And it's a journey. I mean, that's why, like, you know, really the first draft is just the beginning, because you really do have to excavate and figure out what they're about, what's motivating them. And, you know, because that's, in fact, I think that's the most interesting part of the storytelling. And you do discover stuff about yourself in doing that. At least I do.
Yeah, of course, you know, because you learn, mm-hmm. I guess you would learn how you feel about different things.
Absolutely. And what you end up empathizing with, which is going to be interesting.
Yeah, and even your own reactions to events or different things, sometimes mm-hmm. it's surprising, right? And I could imagine. So let's give, like, I've been listening. I should say that as well. In the audiobook, it's great. You have the different people reading different characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that's really fascinating, because I've never had that done with my book. So I think that adds a lot of texture. That's it's almost like listening to the old radio shows.
Yeah, it was really a fun. That was a fun thing, to doing the audiobook, because I mean, I love audiobooks. I love, you know, I commute to work. I'm always listening to them. I'm listening to, you know, radio shows, podcasts, everything. So voices are just really important to me. I was like, well, you know, I really hope that I get to participate in choosing these voices. And they did. And I had some wonderful actresses doing the voices of the two main characters. And of course, the Day of Death part is another actor. So, you know, I think that it creates a sort of texture to it that is really fun to, like, I enjoy that a lot.
Yeah, no, I was surprised, but I was very happy with it. I think it's great. So maybe give a rundown for the listeners. I know it, but give a rundown, basically, of the plot in the story.
Yeah, so Dodging and Burning is really about the central character of the story is this wartime photographer named Jay Greenwood, and he is wounded in battle, and he comes home, and the story really begins in the home front. And he agrees to meet this young woman to take a picture of her for a modeling opportunity that she wants to take advantage of. And when he goes to meet her, he finds that she's been murdered, that she's been beaten to death, and he has his camera with him, and he's trained to sort of dissociate himself from violence. And the sort of mitigating sort of influence is the camera. So he picks up the camera and snaps pictures of it, like, in a sense, record it. And then the two narrators of the story play huge roles. They are Bunny Prescott, who is this debutante, who sort of socialite debutante, who is in love with Jay, unrequitedly, though, because Jay's gay. And then the kid sister of Jay's lover, who's Seal, as I mentioned before, and he shows this the pictures of the corpse to these girls, or tells them about the event, shows the pictures. Of course, when they return to the crime scene, the body is gone, and there's a lot of very little evidence of the crime occurring, so they're stuck with this sort of powerful image, which actually is in the book, and then have to unravel the mystery around, like, around this image, and a lot of questions are emerging about whether, you know, Jay's telling the truth about it altogether, and so that drives the mystery. And it ends up being a lot about Jay's wartime experience, you know, his sort of trauma from the war, and then sort of the role that photography kind of plays in recording, you know, the war, which I'm also pretty fascinated with. So. But yeah, the mystery centers around this murdered woman and kind of who did it. And in a lot of ways, it does still function very much like a mystery story.
Hmm. Wow. And so what do you do for a living? You're a teacher, you said.
Yeah, so I teach high school at an independent day school outside of D.C. called Flint Hill. And it's also run the English department there. So. You know, during my school year, I'm balancing that with trying to get some writing done, which can be interesting. but, Yeah, but, you know, of course, I enjoy it being a great deal, you know, but I think that it is hard to balance the two. I'm actually taking a year off next year just to focus on my writing because I'm pretty excited about that. You know, I'm not sure. I was going to do some research. I'm not sure what the sort of coronavirus is going to, what sort of that's going to, wrench is going to throw in the works, but we'll see.
Yeah, things like that get in the way, right? But you just don't know what to expect,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it did for me. I mean, I was in the middle or three quarters of a way, and I was just going to fly to a city and finish up some more work. But, you know, things happened.
Well, it must be difficult. It must be difficult when you're doing true crime reporting because you really need to have a connection with people. That I'm sure this is making difficult to achieve, you know.
Well, yeah, so, it's really important because, you know, the better books end up having more connections with more people involved in the case, right? The more
you have,
you know, it turns out better. There's more information. It's better rounded.
Sure.
And all that. So, you know, I could probably finish it up, but, you know, I'll wait as long as this isn't too long. You know, it depends how long we get stuck. Where I am in the Western Canada, where both of us are actually, things have seemed to flatten out already, and things are just sitting. But we'll see where it goes. I think things are a little better in this area than back east there, and the U.S. We don't know what's going to happen there.
Right, yeah. It's very interesting to live in a hot spot and a real cold spot in West Virginia, although I'm not convinced that there's more out here than's being recorded just because there's not enough tests. But, you know, it's interesting sort of living in there's two different mentalities if we go back to town for some reason versus out here.
Yeah, it's a strange. I guess now, I don't know about you, but does it put kind of...
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A dark cloud over things, like when something like this happens, or mm-hmm. So the coronavirus is going on, and all of the misinformation and conspiracies and fights going on, and you turn on the news and it's pretty dark overall. Does that change how you write? Does it make it kind of a darker perception and a darker way of writing when you write these books then?
That's really interesting. I mean, I was finishing up the revisions of my second book during, like, when it was all kind of like coming, you know, you know, the initial sort of burst of it in the East and everything. And suddenly school was having to, you know, close and that kind of thing. And I mean, I felt if anything, it became hard to write. It became hard to focus. And I think, you know, there's at some point on Twitter or, you know, one of the social medias, someone said, you know, now people can, you know, something about Shakespeare writing. I can't remember which of his plays, and, you know, when the Black Plague was happening or something. And people were kind of like grumbling about that because it's true. I mean, it was very at the very beginning, it was hard to focus. Because you feel like a big story is happening to you. It's hard to then think about this other story that seems so much smaller in comparison, especially, you know, if it's a piece of fiction. You're like, okay. And then you settle down and realize that, you know, in fact, I've gained some time. I'm not commuting and all this. And so, my husband and I, we do not have children. So we're not dealing with sort of a family, like much sort of, organizing of a family situation at home. So there's a lot of space and time to write. And so, I went from not being able to do much to then suddenly a surge of being able to do a lot, and now I think it's kind of evened out. But yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of people are struggling though, based on a lot of my writer friends. I don't think it's an easy time, but maybe eventually we'll find some sort of equilibrium.
I'm not sure. It shut me down completely so far. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah.
I think not me. I've been kind of, but you know, the thing is, I'm not really good at writing at home either.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that is your case. I do better writing outside of home.
Oh yeah. I guess that would be difficult. No, home is my writing space. I kind of lock myself away in a room and, although I don't mind writing out like at coffee shops or the library or something, that is typically for whatever reason I end up just writing at home. Which is, you know, interesting because I think that's hard for even folks who do normally write at home, especially if their families are there. I know some of my friends haven't been able to write at all because they're home with all their children and everything. And that's, you know, it's just not possible. Yeah.
Well, not me. I'd rather be somewhere else and kind of lost in a crowd. So I'd rather be in a city with a couple million people and that I don't know. And that isolation in that way helps me write. So, you know, I guess it's all different for different people.
I've been writing for 2 years and all of a sudden there's all these people in my space. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, I just want to yell, get off my lawn.
Yeah. Do it. You know, it's really a strange process. Hard to explain at times, but pretty interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
So what do you think what's going on now? We talk about a little bit about things happening now, current affairs. How do you feel about things right now?
I mean, I think that, you know, I think even at the beginning of this, I was telling myself this is not going to be as horrific as the worst case scenario or as good and fast as people want it to be. I mean, in general, I just think we got to be patient and smart. And my real takeaway from it, though, is instead of getting angry that the economy, you know, is a mess and everything, and it's just something we're going to have to live through. It is like a big natural disaster, and you as angry as you get at the situation, there's really nothing to do with it. You can't do anything. So in some ways, I think I personally think folks need to start taking account of what maybe this experience is teaching them about little things. I don't know, whether it's like being out in nature more, you know, or moments that suddenly you're spending more time with your family members. It's interesting because, you know, I'm still doing online instruction with high school students, but their lives, they seem more like happy and stable, you know, now because they're not under all the sort of, because remember, this is like Northern Virginia. A lot of these kids are under a great deal of pressure to get the colleges of their dreams, i.e. their parents' dreams. And, you know, and now, like, a lot of the sort of running around and the nuts, the craziness is just not there anymore. And they're home and they're stable with their families. And they're, like, they're actually writing better and they're thinking more clearly. So it's kind of interesting. Like, I guess what my point is that, you know, settle in, social distance, be safe, but ultimately, like, also see what you can learn under those constraints, you know, like, and so, you know, maybe being bored a little bit's not a terrible thing, but, or spending a little more time in nature or figuring out deepening your relationships with your family members, whatever. I guess, you know, I don't want to say that we shouldn't be concerned. We shouldn't, be in touch and connected with what's going on. But at the same time, I think we always have to be looking at what this is teaching us, which in a lot of ways is like, you know, when you're looking historically, and because I write historical fiction, I'm always thinking about what do we learn now looking back, and now that we're in the midst of something pretty momentous, certainly there will be a big, mark on the timeline, the coronavirus mark on the timeline, like the before and after, and like, what is after? What are we going to take? What's the takeaway from this thing? You know,
I just wonder, but how much do we really learn? We've probably got 30% of the U.S. population believing in a lot of weird history or conspiracies and false.
Yeah.
Stuff going on, and all this stuff's flying around, and look at how many people are starting to picket now, protest, you know, social distancing and all this stuff, and all the things people are saying, and that sort of happened in the Spanish flu, right? And a lot of people died because of it. So I just wonder how much we really learn from these experiences, and maybe some of us, but I just wonder as a nation.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm holding you responsible.
The funny thing is, I speak of, like, the first thing that my husband and I started doing is, like, let's look for podcasts on the Spanish flu and find out what happened then. Because we knew about it vaguely, but I don't think it's something that we teach a lot, you know, in our history courses about it, like, you know, it happened, it was devastating, and then things moved on rather quickly. But now, you know, we can go back and learn about it. And I think that, I mean, there's always going to be a portion of our population, which is, ignorant for a variety of different reasons. And some of it's willful, some of it is because they don't have the resources. Some of it's because no matter what you say on the news, they don't believe it because they believe it's all fake, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the news isn't, very accurate. So it's just, you know, it's people kind of wander around not knowing what to believe. And I wish that, you know, ultimately people would use their reasoning skills a little more and just think through things instead of the sort of gut emotional, like, you know, hunch. They actually laid out the facts in front of them and fought through it. But people, especially these days, ride on their emotions so heavily. I think that sort of set us up for some of the stuff. I think nature itself and the coronavirus was going to teach us, you know, whether you believe it or not, it's coming. You know?
fake news, you know.
Well,
we've been giving out fake news here for quite a while, actually. We enjoy doing that. Oh, it's crazy. I have to say, what is do any other writers influence you, or does music, or what kind of art influences you? What's
absolutely
your favorite?
All sorts of things. Some of my favorite writers, I think, you know, Margaret Atwood has to be very high on my list. In fact, there's a lot of, I don't know if you know the novel, The Blind Assassin, but I love that novel, and it has sort of this layering going on in it. It's much more, I think a more difficult book than Dodging and Burning, but it is essentially a mystery, and I love sort of her, particularly her historical books. Patricia Highsmith, I love, although she was apparently a not very nice person. but I think that she's great at creating unease and dread and tension. And I think that's it's so readable. In terms of, you know, I also love film noir. You probably could pick up on a lot of that in the book. The mood of film noir. I love film in general, and I actually teach a film course. And I think that really plays a big role, as well as photography. Ouija, you know, speaking of true crime, you know the photographer, his real name's Arthur Freilich, but he went by Ouija. Do you know the story?
No.
Yeah, you gotta look Ouija up, because if you're true crime writers, you'll like this guy. In the 1940s, he had a police scanner, and he would listen in, and he would drive, he would listen to the police scanner, and when he heard a crime had occurred, he would drive to the location of the crime and often be the first person on the scene, and he would take pictures. And so, he was also very capable, his pictures are gorgeous and dark and bizarre and disturbing. But they are, you know, essentially journalistic. And he was also making a lot of social commentary too in his photography, but it has this real gritty noir feel to the images. And they called him Ouija because he seemed to sort of appear on the scene of the crime before even the police knew about it. So it was like there was sort of a nod towards he didn't have psychic abilities, had a police scanner, but you know, that sort of spookiness about him.
Yeah.
But his images, I mean, he's a great photographer. Now, people might feel different ways about his images, because they are, in some senses, you know, fairly, you know, explicit and exploitative. So, but they're also really gorgeous and fascinating. And I always love that kind of tension between something that is, you feel it's problematic, but you're still kind of drawn towards it all the same, and moths to the flame a little bit. So, I love stuff like that.
I was just going to say, what were you planning? You said you just finished a book as well, so what, you've got another one coming out soon.
Hopefully. it's also set in 1948, and this one is, oh, rather not also, but it's also set in the 1940s. It's set in 1948, and it's about two teenage girls during that time period who get to know one another and kind of end up having a romance with each other, sort of a la the film Heavenly Creatures. Which I don't know if you know that film at all, but it's based on a true crime. They end up getting involved in a crime, both in solving one and perhaps committing a few along the way. So it's got a real noir feel to it. And I like to think of it as the coming-of-age story of two femme fatales. So, and it's a sort of sympathetic coming-of-age story for a femme fatale.
Now, for listeners, do you have a website or a place that you would want people to come find you and find your books?
Absolutely. It's www.jcopenhaver.com. And also, if you just search my name, it pops up there pretty high on the list, I think.
Fantastic. Well, you know, we will have that on our website as well, and a link to your book so people can do one click when they're listening. Again, this has been fascinating, and I'm glad you took the time to talk to us today. The book we're talking about is Dodging and Burning, and the guest has been the author, John Copenhaver. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been a delight.
Thanks, John. That's great.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.